Accession number 26756, real 4.
But then you got when the forces of law and order all were part of the discrimination against the left. You got the increasing alienation of people who would normally be moderate and not against the state.
Now, in the spring of 46, you were seconded from the army to the British Embassy Press Department.
Correct.
And went to Volos.
Correct.
And then on to Salonika.
Correct.
Again, to what extent by then did you feel that the area was in a state of civil war already by then?
I always thought it might be avoided. I think at that stage I still thought it might have been avoided if there had been really strong measures to pull back the overwhelming discrimination of the right against the left. But I think by the summer of 1946, probably that was optimistic.
And the plebiscite was to be held
in September.
In September. And you mentioned that you did not feel that that should go.
No, I felt it could not be a fair reflection of what people fundamentally felt, because they really saw it as communist-dominated left and a king being non-communist, whom they would not normally vote for, because I mean, Greece has vacillated, has swung between republicanism and royalism over the whole of its history. And I think people who might be natural republicans would have voted for the king, lest a vote against the king appeared a vote for communism. So I thought it was inevitable the king would come back, but I doubt if it really was necessarily the right choice of the Greek people.
How important do you consider the result of the plebiscite to have been?
I think it was important because it reinforced the right in power and their perception and their ability to continue with discrimination against the left. So I think it was inevitable. I think it reinforced a trend.
In your book, you talk a little bit about British press coverage mm-hmm. of events in Greece, and you again had first-hand experience of dealing mm-hmm. with journalists.
Indeed.
Can you describe those your impressions of the journalists with whom you came into contact?
Well, I think I say most of them came to get a byline for the story, without particular interest in the accuracy of that story. Certainly, there were two stories. Immediately after the occupation, there was quite a high caliber of war correspondents who came into Greece. I think they were all in December 1944. The whole attitude of the press was hostile to Britain in favour of allies. I mean, here was a resistance movement being attacked by imperialistic British troops, and this was intolerable to any good journalistic mind. And I think at that stage there was a total misunderstanding of the situation, but gradually the atrocities in Athens, the treatment of hostages, I mean the treatment of hostages taken by Elas from Athens, and the treatment of British prisoners of war, and the refusal to allow Red Cross to visit the prisoners of war, really gradually turned the press round, and this is 1944, December, January 45, and the Times, which had been the worst offender in writing about Greek affairs, gradually came round to recognise that they'd got it wrong. I think by the time we got to 1946, again, the interest of journalists was in, I think, beginning to perceive here was something beginning to blow up. There wasn't the same journalistic interest that there had been in January 45. And as I'd say again, they really came to get a byline for a story and write that story. Because I knew, had known some of the undoubted leaders, such as Ypsilantis. They all wanted me to talk about Ypsilantis, but it really wasn't a story. I mean, I wasn't terribly impressed. I always liked the journalists. I mean, journalists are always very easy people to get on with. but I didn't think anyone at that stage was particularly helpful in conveying to this country the reality of the situation in Greece at that time. It's a good question. I mean, I'm thinking back, Sylvia Sprigg of The Guardian, there was Betty Abatialos, who was married to a Greek communist trade unionist who was in prison, and she was the Daily Worker representative. Most journalists came to flesh out their own prejudices and preconceptions. And I doubt if anyone was... They wouldn't travel very much. I mean, journalists are lazy people, and having been one, I know, you do what is easy. If you read Evelyn Waugh's Scoop, it's the best book on journalism out. Have you read Scoop?
I have, yeah.
Wonderful. You know, the Times correspondent sitting in his cellar. And, no, I don't think the press was helpful. And there's no question that December, January 44, 45, it was enormously unhelpful. They simply, and only Richard Capel, oddly enough, the music critic of the Daily Telegraph, actually came up north to Macedonia in November 44 and talked to some of the British liaison officers and got a different perception of what was happening. But you might say the Telegraph would do that anyhow because it's right wing, but actually Richard Capel did get it right. All the other journalists were saying wicked Churchill, wicked imperialists, poor Ellis.
On the matter of Churchill, you have an anecdote in your book about the reaction of locals to the...
Oh, after the election, yes.
Could you just recount that one?
Oh, if I remember rightly, when Labour won the election, which would be, what, 45, they simply said, has Churchill retreated to the hills? Because, you know, this is what had happened. The left wing being on the run, they fled to the hills.
How significant do you consider the contribution of Albania and Yugoslavia to the growing unrest in Greece, and particularly in Macedonia?
Oh, absolutely critical. As long as the Albanian and Yugoslav borders were open, communist bands could base themselves over the borders in Yugoslavia and Albania. They could have training camps in Yugoslavia, which they had. The extent to which they received arms from Yugoslavia, I'm sure. But it means, like Tom Tiddler's ground, if they were attacked by Greek forces, they'd get up to the frontier. The left-wing bands could retreat over into Yugoslavia or Albania. The Greeks could not follow them. And it was when Tito closed his borders that it was the ultimate blow to the Greek communist, the Democratic Army of Greece, which was fighting government. They were absolutely critical. The accessibility of those countries to the Greek left-wing guerrillas during the build-up to the Civil War and during the Civil War itself in 47-49 was absolutely critical.
Now, how did you yourself come to finally leave Greece?
I was going to be demobbed. I'd done 4.5 years in the army. I was due for demobilisation and I was going to go back to Cambridge. And I left with very mixed feelings because I deeply loved the country and was very fond of the country and the people and was fascinated by it. And I left on Christmas Eve, if I remember rightly, and arrived on Christmas Day 1946. And then I was demobilized in January 1947. And went up to Cambridge that month after 2.5 years in the Mediterranean to the coldest English winter for I don't know how many years. And rationing and everything else.
And you went back, I believe, to Greece in 1949.
Yes, I did indeed. I went back as a journalist. I did some work for The Economist and for the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House. And that was just after the ending of the Civil War. And I travelled up to Macedonia. I travelled very widely, and I wrote a paper for Chatham House, a talk for Chatham House, which was published, and I used it as material for the book I wrote. And it was a country full of suspicions. People were really suspicious. He was a real journalist. They had suffered from an awful lot of false reporting. They had suffered from bogus journalists. So luckily I had pieces of paper on me saying who I was. I went up to the frontier. You could see the villages beginning to go back to their villages from which they had been evacuated. You could go to camps to which people had been evacuated, living in tents. You could go to child towns where the children whose parents had either been killed or been abducted or had actually gone to Eastern Europe because they were left wing. They were these child towns where they were simply children all gathered together. It was a country full of suspicion, but the Americans were very impressive. The Americans who took over from our responsibilities in March 47, I suppose. They were very impressive. I mean, they were very optimistic. They were very unrealistic in some ways, but they were determined to get things done and to get reconstruction going, because Greece was beginning reconstruction 4 years later than any other European country. I mean, the war having ended in 45, and this was 49, Greece having seen almost continuous, latent or actual civil war since the ending of the European war.
And was evidence and of the occupation and the civil war still...
Oh, absolutely. Shattered villages. I mean, still destruction everywhere. Villages which had been burnt by the Italians and the Germans, some of them several times, had been attacked either by the left-wing army or, in some cases, by the government forces. There were attacks on towns, the left-wing attacked Naousa. Still in my time, in what it was November, I suppose, 1946, there was an attack on Naousa. This was repeated again later. There was huge destruction, immense destruction, yes.
So Geoffrey Chandler, Reel 4. Now, in 1996, you returned to Macedonia for... not a reunion as such, but more a conference.
It was a conference devised by villagers in an area called the Voyon on the eastern Pindus, which had been, this particular village, Tsotili, had been burnt, I think, twice by the Italians and once by the Germans. And they realized that all their records had been lost. And if they did not record the oral memories of people who were still alive and who had participated in the 10 years of 1940 to 1950, which encompassed the German occupation and the Civil War, they would lose all records. And they got together a remarkable group of people, some people who had fought on both sides in the Civil War. So there was a general who had fought on the left for the communist forces against the Greek army. There were senior people from the Greek army, and there were people from both political parties, both political factions, some of whom had never met before other than on the battlefield or as captive and captor. And the purpose was to get them to record what they remembered. And what was remarkable was, A, they hadn't changed their opinions on either side, but for the first time they were able to speak out their opinions and memories quite openly within the context of the village, because loyalty to the village is paramount, is probably more important than political affiliation. And there was this group of about 60 or 70 people, and my wife and I were the only foreigners there, because I was asked to give a paper on the genesis of the Civil War. And it was a cathartic occasion for those who spoke. And even, as I say, though they had not changed their mind, at least they could speak their minds, they could talk together, they could feast together. And we had very good feasts in that village and neighboring villages. And this was ultimately recorded as part of the village archive, which otherwise would have been lost, because many of the people there are doubtless who were there are doubtless no longer alive today. It was a very masculine occasion. There were very few women present, almost by definition, because the actors had been male rather than female. It was beautifully chaired. It was highly sensitive. It was a courageous thing to do, because although, 50 years after the events, after the Well, the Civil War ended in, what, 49, and this was, what did I say, what did we say? 96. So, even so, I mean, memories were still quite vivid and bitter. It was a courageous thing to do, but it was very cleverly chaired, and it was kept on a low key, so people could speak what they felt. There was one woman who expostulated to a communist speaker, "Why did you kill my father, who was a judge, and who had simply been killed because he was a political opponent?" But this was not allowed to become a critical area. I mean, it was accepted, it was listened to, and moved on. But I mean, that was a sort of latent tension and anger which could have come out and could have destroyed the conference. In fact, I think there were 14 introductory speeches at the conference by all sorts of notables, eminent people from round about, mayors, nomarchs, people from Athens, people from government, all say what a courageous thing it was to do. And it was courageous, but it did mean that a village which had lost its history was actually regaining its history by this particular method.